Justice Sotomayor said, quote, "Never in the history of our republic has a president had reason to believe that he would be immune from criminal prosecution if he used the trappings of his office to violate the criminal law. Moving forward, however, all former presidents will be cloaked in such immunity. If the occupant of that office misuses official power for personal gain, the criminal law that the rest of us must abide will not provide a backstop. In every use of official power, the president is now a king above the law," unquote. That's a Supreme Court justice saying that, not me. And for what it's worth, Justice Jackson said the same thing. And I don't know how this can be interpreted any other way.
I am so damn tired of being lied to. I don't think I can deny it anymore.
Hello, my friend, and thank you for listening to the 295th episode of this listener-supported podcast called Congressional Dish. I'm your host, Jennifer Briney. And this episode, so the Supreme Court issued a whole packet of decisions in the last 2 weeks, and a few of them are going to affect the way our government functions in ways that I simply have to address. And so I decided to just pop on here, give you an episode discussing these cases, because one of them, a couple of them actually, is directly related to how Congress writes bills. And so that's also going to affect how I discuss bills on this podcast. And then the other Supreme Court decision that I'm going to highlight is just too consequential to be ignored. Let's not waste any time and get right into it. So the first decision that's going to change how our government functions, specifically how Congress operates and how I will read and analyze the laws they pass, is a decision that, at the heart of it, has to do with how Congress writes laws. Because Congress, when it writes laws, doesn't fully write the laws. And it's been driving me crazy for 12 years. What Congress does instead, all the time, is that it will create a new program, but leave damn near all of the important details up to the executive branch agency that is in charge of implementing that new law. When this happens, the executive branch agencies, like the Environmental Protection Agency or the Food and Drug Administration or Health and Human Services or whatever, but that agency will fill in the details that Congress failed to write themselves via regulations. Basically, in writing the details for how a law will be enforced, the agencies often have to write the rules themselves. And in effect, Congress has for a long time been surrendering its power to the executive branch, because it's the executive branch agencies who have been deciding how our laws will actually affect us, because Congress has been too lazy, or more likely politically cowardly, to write the details into the actual laws. Congressional cowards let the agencies be the bad guys. It's like, don't blame me, donor. It wasn't me, your paid-off member of Congress who capped insulin prices at $35 and limited your profits on a life-sustaining drug. That was the Biden administration. Or like, don't blame me, voter. It wasn't me that created the fee that's crippling your business. I just voted for a bill that allowed fees. It was the Trump administration that chose to charge the fee to you. But the game is blame them, blame the agencies, blame the regulations. And so writing vague laws and forcing the unpopular details to be written by the agencies is a blame game that honestly has served congressional cowards well. And since 1984, since a case moved through the courts involving the fossil fuel corporation Chevron, courts have been essentially required to defer to the judgments that the agencies make in interpreting the vague instructions they are given in Congress's laws. Now, on the one hand, this can be good because the agencies tend to be staffed with people who are experts in their fields. And when they are operating in good faith, experts would seem to be the people that we would want writing the rules that govern what chemicals can be put in our food, what quantities of poisons can be sprayed on plants in our neighborhoods, what drugs are safe for us to use. Experts should make those decisions. But when experts, or empowered non-experts, end up controlling executive branch law enforcing agencies and acting in bad faith, when they act as moles in our government there to rip up the rules so that corporations can be free to make money in any means that they want, well, allowing agencies to make the rules can then be a problem. Because do we want corporate moles in government to be able to determine what chemicals can be put in our food? What quantities of poisons can be sprayed on plants in our neighborhoods? What drugs are safe for us to use? Corporate moles empowered by big business beholden presidents are not the best people to make those decisions. And the regulations, because of the vagueness of the actual laws, and because we change administrations every 4 to 8 years, well, the regulations are changing too, depending on who is president and who therefore staffs the agencies. And what we've ended up with is regulatory whiplash. Let's look at the EPA for an example. When President Obama was in charge, his Environmental Protection Agency used the vague parts of the Clean Air Act to try to implement a clean power plan, declaring carbon a pollutant, even though that was never declared in a congressionally written law. The Supreme Court actually stepped in and paused Obama's clean power plan because the EPA's authority to declare carbon a pollutant was so unclear. But then an election happened, and President Trump happened, and he put a corporate mole in charge of the EPA. And that mole repealed Obama's clean power plan and then did nothing to limit carbon pollution. Now, had Congress written a law that said something to the effect of, like, carbon is a pollutant and the EPA must take all necessary action to reduce carbon emissions from power plants by half by 2030, or something like that. But had Congress put that into a law, there would have been much less ambiguity. A goal would have been set. Carbon would have been classified in law, not regulation, as a pollutant that must be limited. But the fossil fuel industry would punish members of Congress financially for voting for a sentence like that, especially in the Republican Party of pollution. And so by leaving laws vague, Congress creates these situations where regulations are left to the whims of whoever is in charge, and no one in Congress can be blamed for what happens. Everyone can say that the regulations are the devils. But things are now going to fundamentally change because the Supreme Court, in a case called Loper Bright Enterprises versus Raimondo, Secretary of Commerce, well, in that case, the Supreme Court essentially ruled last week that when Congress writes a law that is vague, it's up to the courts to decide what is the intent of Congress in those laws, not the agencies. Now, in this particular case, an executive branch agency, using vague permission to create fees written into a law, had created a rule that required fishermen to pay approximately $710 a day to have an observer on board their boat, which was a government requirement to ensure fishermen were not overfishing. Now, this was fine when the government was paying that fee, but they decided to switch that fee over to the fishermen's books. But that expense for the fishermen wasn't written into the law. That was an agency decision to make the fishermen pay for that out-of-pocket fee. And so in ruling on behalf of the family of fishermen who couldn't afford that high fee, the court ruled that courts had the right to determine what the law intended, not the agency that set that fee. And the reaction to this Supreme Court ruling has been dramatic, varying drastically depending on who has been doing the reacting. You know, this has been branded as the end of the administrative state, and with that proclamation sounding different depending on the mouth it's coming from. So it's the end of the administrative state, people, are those that have dedicated their advocacy to destroying the government from within. Those are the people who are celebrating this as the end of regulations. But then there's it's the end of the administrative state, people. And those are the ones who believe that government regulations play an important role in protecting us from all kinds of dangers posed by corporate freedom. And those are the people who are acting like we're all doomed. But in my opinion, everyone is overreacting to this decision. Because government was able to regulate just fine before 1984. When the Chevron case caused the courts to start treating agency interpretations of law as if they were fact. And that tells me that laws and regulations will continue to exist and be enforced just as they were before the Chevron precedent was set. Also, in the laws that I have read that have done this, that have transferred the power to write the details to the executive branch agencies, the laws are always quite clear about what agency they intend to transfer that power to. They always name the secretary of the agency whom they are entrusting to write the rules. And so it's not hard to imagine a sentence becoming kind of standard language that says something to the effect of, the court shall treat the regulations of the secretary of whatever as if they have the force of law, or something like that. I don't know. But Congress should be able to pretty easily tell the court whom they intend to trust with the interpretation of the law they are writing in the parts where the law is vague. That said, though, it's been about 40 years, and a lot of vague laws without clarification clauses like that have been passed during that time. Which means you would think that there is likely going to be a flood of lawsuits against the government challenging existing regulations, and a lot of attempts to reopen settled cases. And there probably are. But there is one part of the Supreme Court ruling that is likely to kill a lot of those lawsuits before they even begin, particularly the ones that would be reopening settled cases. So here's a passage that should give at least a little comfort to those who have been led to believe that this ruling is a catastrophe. And so, quoting from the Supreme Court decision, quote, "By overruling Chevron, though, the court does not call into question prior cases that relied on the Chevron framework. The holdings of those cases that specific agency actions are lawful, including the Clear Act holding of Chevron itself, are still subject to statutory stare decisis, despite the court's change in interpretive methodology. Mere reliance on Chevron cannot constitute a special justification for overruling such a holding," unquote. Now, stare decisis is Latin for, quote, "to stand by things decided," unquote. And so the Supreme Court essentially said in that paragraph that previous cases against regulations are decided. And if reliance on agency judgment is the only thing that has changed since a case was decided, that paragraph in the ruling would kill the legal challenge. But in my crystal ball, I do see a lot of upcoming new legal challenges to existing regulations, especially in light of another Supreme Court decision this week that essentially removes the statute of limitations on suing the government for regulations. Because until this week, if a company or a person didn't like a regulation, they had 6 years to challenge that regulation in court. And so, for example, if a company didn't like a fee that the government required them to pay that went into effect in 2011, they had until 2017 to file a lawsuit. If they waited until after that, too bad. But in the case that was just ruled on in the Supreme Court, in Corner Post, Inc. versus the Board of Governors of the Federal Reserve, the company, Corner Post, didn't open and therefore didn't start paying the fee until 2018, after the statute of limitations had run out. The court ruled that the company had a right to challenge the fee, that the company had 6 years to challenge the fee, regardless of when the fee went into effect for everybody else. Essentially, the court ruled that the statute of limitations is now specific to each person or company, saying the clock start time is different for different people. And so with that expanded definition of statute of limitations, plus the change that allows the courts to determine what Congress intends in law, as opposed to the agencies Congress tasks with writing the regulations, well, due to this package of rulings, whether we like it or not, or whether it makes sense to us or not, there are going to be a lot of legal challenges to regulations. And the outcomes of those are likely to depend on what judges hear the cases. Put plainly, this is an expansion of judicial power. Judges will decide what Congress intends when it's not clear. And so that means that executive branch agencies are losing a power that they've essentially had for 40 years. And it's going to be messy. And it's all because of Congress. Congress causes this problem by writing vague laws. But that means that Congress is also the solution to it. And that's the good news. There is a solution to it. So if, for example, we want agencies and the experts within them to fill in the details that are not written in law by Congress during the regulation process, Congress can write and pass a law telling the courts that they need to defer to the judgment of the agencies as they have since 1984, if that is in fact Congress's intent in writing the laws the way they do. And they can do this via a blanket law that tells the courts to defer to agencies in general, or they can do it bill by bill, although a bill-by-bill method doesn't fix the 40 years' worth of problems in current law. And to limit lawsuits against regulations, Congress can write a law that says that the statute of limitations on suing the government is not specific to each person, but is generalized. Congress can write a law that says, for example, a regulation can be challenged by anyone and everyone for 6 years total and that's it, if that's what we want, although I'm not sure we do. But basically, what I'm saying is that nothing that was done by the Supreme Court to the administrative state via these particular cases are actions that can't be undone. Congress has the power to change the law to make it crystal clear who Congress wants to delegate its voice to, the agencies or the courts. And more generally, Congress can be, and in fact must be, much more detailed in the laws that it writes. And I suspect that an upcoming theme in this podcast is going to be watching Congress as it is forced to revisit laws it has already passed and fill in the details. or not. Because while Congress has the power to contain the chaos, there are bad faith actors in this Congress, a lot of them, who are hell-bent on breaking our government, and for whom chaos is their goal. And if we keep empowering these kinds of people and adding to their ranks, more chaos is exactly what we're going to get. Quite simply, if you want a functional government, you have to vote for people promising to create one. You cannot vote for people promising to destroy our government if you don't want it destroyed. And this shouldn't need saying, but it clearly does. You shouldn't be rooting for your government to be destroyed. It is not a smart or cool position to take. Because when your water is poisoned, when your air is poisoned, when your home is taken from you by a bank that doesn't even have the paperwork proving that they have the right to take it, or when you're fired for no reason, or a passing train blows up your town, when the protections of government are gone, you're going to miss having a government. You're going to miss the unelected bureaucrats whose job it was to prevent companies from firing you or ripping you off or putting you and the Americans you love in physical danger. We need a Congress staffed with people who want the government to function. And that just got so much more important because of these Supreme Court decisions. But I'm not afraid of the Supreme Court decisions, because in some ways I agree with them. Like, agencies shouldn't be able to write rules that function as laws. Agencies are law enforcement. Writing laws is Congress's job. And we should be able to legally challenge regulations that aren't actually laws. So these decisions don't scare me because the solution is so clear, if a solution is needed. Congress is the solution. But that's what scares me. I'm afraid that Congress is the solution because we have done such a terrible job staffing the place. I don't trust our members of Congress right now, and quite frankly, I don't trust the American voters right now either. Because for 12 years, I've witnessed the Republican Party in particular get crazier and crazier, borderline anarchist in many ways. They are legislative wrecking balls. You know, it's so easy to destroy, and the plan they operate on is so easy to understand. Destroy the laws, destroy regulations, government bad, private sector good. You know, any moron can get on board, and boy, have they. It's like, damn the man. It's so edgy. It's so cool. Until it's not. Until you want someone to stop that company from poisoning your family. Until you want to stop the bank that tricked you into a scam loan from taking your car or your house. Until you want someone to be punished for selling you a baby bed they knew was dangerous for a decade, which caused your kid to die. Who are you going to turn to in these situations without a functional government, huh? Who's going to police the corporations if we dismantle our own government, if we allow the law enforcement agencies to be gutted? The Republican Party, as it is right now, stands for that kind of destruction. And the Democrats, I don't know what their problem is. Their weakness is so systemic that I do question if it's on purpose. Because Democrats in Congress, they take a lot of corporate money too. And I often think that they pretend to care about government while taking corporate cash and letting Republicans play the role of shameless bad guys. Seems to be working out for them politically, maybe. I don't know. I don't understand what's going on in the Democratic Party. I'm not a DC insider. But what I do know is that Congress can stop all nightmare scenarios. But will they? That's where my fear lies. I don't trust the people currently controlling Congress. And I don't trust us to replace them with better people this year. American voters keep voting these people back in at rates that inspire no faith in us at all. But the silver lining that we need to keep in mind is that there is a path out of any trouble that arises from these particular decisions. Unfortunately, the path runs through Congress, but it does exist. And as long as we know that, what's done can be undone. I can't say that for the other Supreme Court decision, though. You know, so many times, as with the cases I just told you about, I see the online freak out, and then I read the document and I feel better, because the extremes, while loud, are so often overblown. But for the first time, I read a Supreme Court decision and felt dramatically worse. And that's the decision in the case called Trump versus the United States, which is such a fitting name in so many ways. In this case, ex-President Donald Trump, you may have heard of him, An attempt to get himself out of legal trouble for the coup plot he orchestrated in the months between the election he lost in November 2020 and President Biden's inauguration in January 2021. Well, Donald Trump argued that as president, he had absolute immunity from prosecution and therefore shouldn't be prosecuted for his coup attempt. And if you don't know why I call it a coup attempt, you could be forgiven for that because it hasn't been well explained to the American public. But that term is accurate, and the attempt was a much longer event than the events of the riot on January 6, 2021. If you haven't already, I am begging you at this point to take the time to listen to the Congressional Dish episode called Contriving January 6th. That's episode 266. And it's currently tied for first place in our most valuable episodes list, as determined by our executive producers, who have paid to put their personal vouchers on that particular episode. But for that episode, I sat through every boring, partisan, overly theatrical minute of the January 6th committee hearings, over 20 hours of hearings. And for you, I cut out all of the fluff and in 2 hours gave you the most important testimony, highlighting four main events in the Trump campaign's attempted coup. And the riot was only one part, although it is the one part that the Democrats remain totally fixated on, to theirs and the American people's detriment. But it's actually other parts of the coup attempt that should be highlighted, such as the attempts to pressure state officials to change election results in Donald Trump's favor, and to pressure Justice Department officials to claim the election was fraudulent. This included a discussion, avoided only upon threat of mass resignations, of replacing the sitting Attorney General Jeff Rosen with an unqualified MAGA moron named Jeff Clark, who would say in writing that the Justice Department had discovered fraud in the election, even though they hadn't. And the most important testimony concerned Donald Trump and his co-conspirators, essentially tricking people into signing fake documents claiming that Donald Trump won in 7 states that he had actually lost. And then, once those documents were created and formally submitted to Congress and the executive branch as if they were the real documents, there was the intense public and private pressure campaign by Donald Trump and his co-conspirators to attempt to get Vice President Mike Pence to knowingly use those fake documents in the official voting counting ceremony on January 6, 2021, in order to either get the 7 states set aside, which would give Donald Trump the favorable electoral vote count that he would need to stay president, or to simply cause enough chaos to cause the election to be determined in the House of Representatives, where theoretically Trump would have enough Republican votes to stay president. It was a long shot, but the plan did make sense. It could have worked. And Team Trump made a real go at it. And they all belong in cages for the attempt. I think that episode is the best work I've ever done, as the testimony tells the full story in a way that I don't think anyone else has. It's just the facts with a focus on the real crime, which wasn't the riling up of the bumpkin mob, but was in the creation and the submission of fake election certifications as part of an attempt to remain president despite losing the election. And for that crime, former President Trump is being prosecuted by the Justice Department. And as a part of that prosecution, Donald Trump and his lawyers claimed that he couldn't be prosecuted because as president, he said he had, quote, absolute immunity from criminal prosecution, unquote. And to be honest with you, I knew that a ruling on this was expected in the last week or two, but I wasn't at all worried about it because that claim seemed so absurd on its face. Because isn't it a foundational principle in the United States of America that no one is above the law? Isn't that why we have three co-equal branches of government, so that each can serve as checks on the other? And isn't the threat of prosecution for crimes the way that the Justice Department checks the executive? This seems so basic. In fact, it was dismissed as absurd by the lower courts. But through a bunch of challenges, the claim made it all the way to the Supreme Court. And this week, the Supreme Court ruled 6-3 along partisan appointment lines that the President of the United States, quote, quoting from the Supreme Court decision, is entitled to at least presumptive immunity from prosecution for all his official acts. There is no immunity for unofficial acts, unquote. And so absolute immunity is not a thing. But partial immunity has now been officially granted to the President of the United States for all of his official acts. So what's an official act? There's a lot of things on the list. So official acts include, according to the opinion written by Chief Justice John Roberts, commanding the armed forces of the United States, granting pardons for offenses against the United States, appointing people to government positions, including the Supreme Court, foreign relations responsibilities, crafting treaties, intelligence gathering, managing the spooks. The president also manages matters related to terrorism. He manages trade. He manages immigration. And domestically, he has to, quoting from the Constitution, take care that the laws be faithfully executed via the actions of the executive branch agencies, unquote. And then finally, the president plays a role in lawmaking by recommending policy to Congress and signing or vetoing bills that Congress passes. There's a lot of actions that can be weaseled into one of those extremely broad categories. And the intelligence gathering one catches my eye specifically. The president is in charge of the spooks who do everything in secret. Our assassination squads? That's the intelligence agencies. And he gets immunity for what they do on his orders? Uh-oh. But regardless, and despite the vast scope of actions that the president is now immune from prosecution for, that was not technically an outright win for President Trump and all former and future presidents, because the Supreme Court ruled that, quote, the separation of powers does not bar a prosecution predicated on the president's unofficial acts, unquote. And so the key question from now on forward is going to be, where is the line between what is an official act and what is an unofficial act? And according to this Supreme Court ruling, we don't know. And the Supreme Court didn't bother with that one. They said that, quote, no court thus far has drawn that distinction, unquote. And so we're in uncharted waters now. And instead of drawing a line between official and unofficial acts, the Republican-appointed Supreme Court justices are throwing those pesky details back to the lower courts to deal with. But the court did give some guidance to the lower courts for how they should deal with the question of official acts versus unofficial acts in the Trump coup attempt case specifically. And since we covered the congressional investigation into that coup attempt in such detail, here's what we know from the Supreme Court decision and how it's likely to affect the prosecution of Donald Trump for that coup attempt. So first of all, the most important thing is that this decision and the fact that the courts now have to figure out what is an official act and what is an unofficial act and how that affects the chain of evidence, that's an enormous task. It will take months, if not years, which means there will not be a trial before the 2024 election. And that's a tragedy. Because too few Americans understand the coup plot the way the loyal listeners to Congressional Dish understand it. Seriously, stop what you're doing and listen to that episode, number 266, Contriving January 6th, and then share it with everyone you know in the United States. If you haven't heard it yet, you may be happy to hear that I'm not in it very much. The vast majority of that episode is straight testimony with me making introductions. So even the people in your life who you think will hate me, well, there's not much me in that episode. It's a safe one to share. But that story needs to be told, and I was counting on at least one of the prosecutions to go forward before the election, because there is a prosecution for the coup attempt in the state of Georgia, but that's stalled out too for the prosecutor is a dipshit reasons. But both prosecutions are now on hold, and we're not going to get the wall-to-wall coverage of every detail of the trial like we just got with the porn star case. But we deserve that for this case before we go to vote and before we possibly allow this man to be empowered again. The fact that I can say fake elector and still get a what's that in response so many times, that indicates that so many voters are missing critical information about what Trump did. And the delay of this trial ensures that will remain the case. Unless my episode or something like it goes super viral, but I'm not holding my breath. And that breaks my heart. We need that trial and we're not going to get it. And if Donald Trump wins, he'll have the power to pardon himself, at least in the federal investigation, and that'll be the end of it. But if he doesn't win, if what remains of Joe Biden is somehow able to pull off a win, even though it will take a while, the case against Donald Trump can continue, but with some serious strings now restraining it. So first, in general, the Republican Party appointed justices on the Supreme Court said that, quote, testimony or private records of the president or his advisors probing such conduct may not be admitted as evidence at trial, unquote. And so much of the testimony we heard that explains the whole picture of the coup attempt, because there were so many people involved, But it comes from the people who worked for Trump and his accomplices, all of whom were Republicans, by the way. But those are the people who told us what he was doing and why. And the Republican Party appointed justices on the Supreme Court just blinded the juries to all of that testimony. That's a huge blow to the case and to any future justice against any criminal president. Did the Supreme Court just make all presidential communications private confessionals where crimes can be plotted in a place floating above the law? Well, Justice Sonia Sotomayor in her scathing dissent seems to think so. She said, quote, "The majority declares that evidence concerning acts for which the president is immune can play no role in any criminal prosecution against him. That holding, which will prevent the government from using a president's official acts to prove knowledge or intent in prosecuting private offenses, is nonsensical," unquote. And even though the Supreme Court is allowing for the president to be prosecuted for crimes committed outside of his or her official duties, the shielding of evidence committed while at work is going to have an effect on those prosecutions, too. Sotomayor said, quote, "Even though the majority's immunity analysis purports to leave unofficial acts open to prosecution, its draconian approach to official acts evidence deprives these prosecutions of any teeth. If the former president cannot be held criminally liable for his official acts, those acts should still be admissible to prove knowledge or intent in criminal prosecutions of unofficial acts," unquote. The example she gives is, quote, "Imagine a president states in an official speech that he intends to stop a political rival from passing legislation that he opposed, no matter what it takes to do so. Official act. He then hires a private hitman to murder that political rival. Unofficial act. Under the majority's rule, the murder indictment could include no allegation of the president's public admission of premeditated intent to support the mens rea of murder," unquote. Or, imagine a president gets up on stage and publicly tells the vice president to use fake election certifications during a ceremony. Imagine that government after government official told that president that his actions were illegal. Imagine that a president threatened to fire people unless they spread his lies. None of those actions can be used as evidence because he did them while working? Even Justice Amy Comey Barrett, who was appointed by Trump himself and who sided with the majority on the case as a whole, she dissented on this part, saying that, quote, "The Constitution does not require blinding juries to the circumstances surrounding conduct for which presidents can be held liable," unquote. So that's crazy. And then another broad judgment made by the Republican-appointed Supreme Court justices was the ruling that, quote, "In dividing official from unofficial conduct, courts may not inquire into the president's motives," unquote. Well, if motives can't be factored in, how do you establish that he was trying to remain president for his own personal gain, for private, unofficial purposes, and not because he thought he actually won the election and was defending the country or whatever? Isn't motive central to the question of whether an act is official, a part of the job, or unofficial, as in intended for a private, unofficial purpose? I don't understand how any president can be proven to be acting out of unofficial private self-interest without examining motive. And so obviously, this is another major blow to the case and to future justice. And then looking at the four segments of the coup plot individually, the Supreme Court did give specific guidance to the lower courts on all of them. So it fully gutted any charges related to Trump threatening to replace acting Attorney General Jeff Rosen with the MAGA sheep Jeff Clark. And this rationale is based on the fact that the president's job requires him to have the power to fire any of his subordinates, which includes the attorney general. And because the president can't be prosecuted for his actions in regards to hiring and firing personnel, he can't be prosecuted for threatening to fire the attorney general, even for corrupt motives. As for the riot, this one's kind of interesting. The Supreme Court said that the president's communications with the public are generally a part of his official duties, but sometimes they're not. Sometimes he's acting in an unofficial capacity as a candidate or as a party leader. And on January 6th, he was speaking at a rally, which was essentially a campaign rally, which might make his speech that riled up the bumpkins an unofficial act. And even if it does end up not subject to prosecution on First Amendment grounds, his words could possibly still be used to determine motive. I remember that speech well, since I had to watch it over and over again while editing Contriving January 6th. And his words on that stage were quite incriminating in regards to him publicly pressuring Vice President Mike Pence to use the fake election certifications during the counting ceremony. And that might be critical because according to the Supreme Court ruling, quote, "Whenever the president and vice president discuss their official responsibilities, they engage in official conduct. Presiding over the January 6th certification proceeding at which members of Congress count the electoral votes is a constitutional and statutory duty of the vice president. The indictment's allegations that Trump attempted to pressure the vice president to take particular acts in connection with his role at the certification proceeding thus involve official conduct, and Trump is at least presumptively immune from prosecution for such conduct. But a rally isn't a discussion, and a rally isn't a presidential duty. And that could end up being really important in terms of what can be used as evidence. Basically, Trump is presumed immune, and the Supreme Court says, quote, it is the government's burden to rebut the presumption of immunity, unquote. And so the lower courts are ordered to determine whether a prosecution involving Trump's attempts to get Vice President Pence to use the fake documents in the certification ceremony would, quote, pose any dangers of intrusion on the authority and functions of the executive branch, unquote. If they don't, it's possible the prosecution could proceed. And then finally, the fake electors. Trump is claiming that his pressuring of people outside of the executive branch to create fake election certifications is a part of his official duties to ensure the integrity and proper administration of the election, which the Justice Department says is nonsense. Elections are administered at the state level, and the president has no role in the administration of elections. And all the Supreme Court says is that the key thing that needs to be determined is whether or not Trump's actions were a part of his official role as president. That will determine whether or not he can be prosecuted for the clearest example of fraud imaginable. And so the fake elector schemes remains the one to watch. The only true defeat for Team Trump in this Supreme Court decision were related to impeachment. Because Trump claimed that because he wasn't convicted by the Senate during impeachment and removed and barred from office, that he can't be prosecuted. He was basically claiming that impeachment and removal is a necessary prerequisite to prosecution, and the court flatly rejected that. The court said, quote, transforming the political process of impeachment into a necessary step in the enforcement of criminal law finds little support in the text of the Constitution or the structure of the nation's government, unquote. But it does bring up my anger bubbles all over again, being reminded that had the Democrats not rushed and botched the impeachment, Trump could have been prevented from being empowered ever again. The Democrats chose to impeach first and investigate second. And so when they impeached the f***er, they didn't know about the fake election certifications and how far Team Trump was willing to go to get them signed and submitted to Congress. They didn't have the Eastman memo, which laid out their entire plan in 2 pages that any dope can understand. Instead, the Democrats rushed it. And the impeachment focused entirely on the drama of the riot. I made a whole episode about it. And you know, even from this episode, how seriously I take this. And I would have had to acquit Trump based on the actual charges brought and the evidence presented by the Democrats in that impeachment. It was a total botch job, and it's one that I don't think I can ever forgive that party for. Trump remains a threat to our government and to the world because, well, the Republicans are shameless, power-hungry, big business beholden jackals who will nominate anyone if they think that person can win. But the Democrats are ineffective, dramatic crybabies incapable of acting strategically. Basically, we're living in a country run by imbeciles. And while I'm on the subject of imbeciles in January 6th, there was one more Supreme Court case that I will quickly mention because it's one that could help some of the imbeciles who participated in the riot get out of jail free too. In a case called Fisher versus the United States, the Supreme Court ruled that the charge of obstructing an official proceeding, which approximately 340 rioting f**ktards have pled guilty to already, is actually only supposed to apply to people who impaired the ability of evidence in a proceeding. So like if they stole the certification documents, or perhaps submitted fake ones to be used instead. Now this is good news for the bumpkins who just entered the building, because simply delaying the proceeding is no longer going to count to this charge. And apparently 52 of the dimwit rioters were only charged with this and might have their records wiped clean. But most of those 340 people have multiple charges, and so this might reduce some sentences, but many will still be punished for the other more serious offenses related to assault and property destruction. But in regards to Donald Trump's obstruction of official proceeding charge, well, he's accused of conspiring to create and submit fake documents to both Congress and the executive branch for that particular proceeding. And so I'm pretty sure he can still be charged with this offense. So that's fun. But for the most part, I see this week as historically bad news. And that really has very little to do with Donald Trump. He's just an extremely unpleasant sideshow in the grand scheme of things. Because going back to the case granting the president presumptive immunity for his official actions taken as president, this is just a passage of judgment that will live in infamy. Quote, "When the president exercises authority, Congress cannot act on and courts cannot examine the president's actions. It follows that an act of Congress, either a specific one targeted at the president or a generally applicable one, may not criminalize the president's actions within his exclusive constitutional power. Neither may the courts adjudicate a criminal prosecution that examines such presidential actions. The court thus concludes that the president is absolutely immune from criminal prosecution for conduct within his exclusive sphere of constitutional authority," unquote. And the reason the Republican Party appointed justices ruled this way was out of a fear, as they call it, quote, "the likely prospect of an executive branch that cannibalizes itself, with each successive president free to prosecute his predecessors, yet unable to boldly and fearlessly carry out his duties for fear that he may be next," unquote. And yet, we've had over 40 presidents, some who hated each other, and this is the first one to be criminally prosecuted. As Justice Sotomayor put it, quote, "that restraint is telling," unquote. But over and over again, the Republican Party appointed majority expresses concern that having to follow the law would restrain the president from acting. The fear was that, quote, "the hesitation to execute the duties of his office fearlessly and fairly that might result when a president is making decisions under a pall of potential prosecution," unquote. And in fact, the Republican Party appointed majority said that, quote, "the court's dominant concern was to avoid diversion of the president's attention during the decision-making process caused by needless worry as to the possibility of damages, actions stemming from any particular official decision," unquote. They expressed this fear repeatedly. Quote, "immunity is required to safeguard the independence and effective functioning of the executive branch and to enable the president to carry out his constitutional duties without undue caution," unquote. Undue caution? We have a former president who authorized a torture program. We have a former president who drone bombed, who killed two American citizens. We have a former president who assassinated foreign leaders and then bragged about it. We have a former president who dropped nuclear bombs and obliterated two entire cities in an instant. Where exactly is this undue caution that the Republican-appointed Supreme Court justices are so concerned about? Because I don't see it evidenced anywhere in our recent history. And Justice Sotomayor couldn't find it either. She said, quote, "one wonders why requiring some small amount of his attention or his legal advisor's attention to go towards complying with federal criminal law is such a great burden. If the president follows the law that he must take care to execute, he has not been rendered unduly cautious," unquote. Sotomayor goes on to say, quote, "it is a far greater danger if the president feels empowered to violate federal criminal law, buoyed by the knowledge of future immunity. I am deeply troubled by the idea, inherent in the majority's opinion, that our nation loses something valuable when the president is forced to operate within the confines of federal criminal law," unquote. It's a baffling proposition that the chief law enforcement officer should find following the law too burdensome. And I tried really hard to understand how the Republican-appointed Supreme Court justices could possibly find this ruling constitutional, because I've read the Constitution. And as noted by Justice Sotomayor, the Constitution's text contains no provision for immunity from criminal prosecution for former presidents, even though it does provide limited immunity for other office holders, such as senators and representatives under some circumstances, indicating that the founders were considering immunity when writing our Constitution and chose to leave out an immunity clause for the president. And in context, that choice makes sense considering that this nation was founded after an escape from the kingdom of King George III, who was considered a tyrant. And so why would the founders create a new government and give one man immunity from the law? Why would they grant the president immunity from laws similar to those enjoyed by the king whose tyranny they had just escaped? They wouldn't. In fact, they divided power amongst three branches in order to limit the power of any one of them. It just doesn't make any sense on its face. The only place where the Constitution addresses legal liability of presidents, it pretty clearly implies that the president is subject to lawsuits. The impeachment judgment clause says that an official impeached, quote, shall nevertheless be liable and subject to indictment, trial, judgment, and punishment according to law, unquote. Put another way, it says that no matter what happens in an impeachment proceeding, a president is subject to prosecution for the same conduct that that person got impeached for. Basically, the Constitution warns the powerful that they can get in double trouble for breaking the law while serving the public. And former presidents have acted accordingly. The dissent points out that former President Ford pardoned former President Nixon, a pardon that he accepted, because both presidents were operating with the understanding that the former president faced criminal liability for his actions taken while president. Whether you're looking at the Constitution, or precedent, or history, or common sense, this ruling, it just doesn't make sense. The Supreme Court majority can say that the president is not above the law all they want, and they do in fact say that exact sentence multiple times. But if everything a president does while working is not only immune from prosecution, but also inadmissible in court, the presidency acts as a giant blindfold over the eyes of justice. And now, the president, whoever that person is, will know that they have this superpower that no other American has. Justice Sotomayor said, quote, "Never in the history of our republic has a president had reason to believe that he would be immune from criminal prosecution if he used the trappings of his office to violate the criminal law. Moving forward, however, all former presidents will be cloaked in such immunity. If the occupant of that office misuses official power for personal gain, the criminal law that the rest of us must abide will not provide a backstop. In every use of official power, the president is now a king above the law," unquote. That's a Supreme Court justice saying that, not me. And for what it's worth, Justice Jackson said the same thing. And I don't know how this can be interpreted any other way. And so, what is our current king doing about it? Because President Biden did come right out as soon as this was issued, a few hours later, on July 1st, 2024, and gave a speech that was under 5 minutes. But here is what he told the country.
This nation was founded on the principle that there are no kings in America. Each of us is equal before the law. No one is above the law, not even the President of the United States. With today's Supreme Court decision on presidential immunity, that fundamentally changed. For all practical purposes, today's decision almost certainly means that there are virtually no limits on what a president can do. This is a fundamentally new principle, and it's a dangerous precedent, because the power of the office will no longer be constrained by the law, even including the Supreme Court of the United States. The only limits will be self-imposed by the president alone.
Okay, so he understands the problem. That's good. What's he going to do about it?
I know I will respect the limits of the presidential powers I have for 3.5 years. But any president, including Donald Trump, will now be free to ignore the law.
Really? Just trust me? Like, that's it? Like, I'm a good guy. Don't worry about me, but that other guy. I mean, that is pretty much all he had to offer. He came out and just basically gave a campaign speech.
So now the American people have to do what the courts should have been willing to do, but will not. The American people have to render a judgment about Donald Trump's behavior. The American people must decide whether Donald Trump's assault on our democracy on January 6th makes him unfit for public office in the highest office in the land. The American people must decide if Trump's embrace of violence to preserve his power is acceptable. Perhaps most importantly, the American people must decide if they want to entrust the president once again, the presidency, to Donald Trump, now knowing he'll be even more emboldened to do whatever he pleases whenever he wants to do it.
But this isn't just about Donald Trump. What about the president after him, and the president after him, and the president after him? This is the problem with the office itself. And he offered no solution other than just vote for me. There was no suggestion of, we're looking into our options and we'll get back to you, or the solution that has been offered by a lot of people, which is expanding the court so that he can use whatever power he has to overturn this madness. There are things that he could do, at the very least telling us he's looking into it, but he didn't do that. He turned this into a campaign speech, and a shitty one at that. And here's how he ended this little campaign speech.
I concur with Justice Sotomayor's dissent today. Here's what she said. She said, in every use of official power, the president is now a king above the law. With fear for our democracy, I dissent. End of quote. So should the American people dissent. I dissent. May God bless you all, and may God help preserve our democracy. Thank you. And may God protect our children.
Well, okie dokie then. The man who has now gotten immunity from prosecution, he doesn't like it. That should make us all feel great. He doesn't want his new powers. Right. And the man who has been handed this massive expansion of power is apparently powerless to do anything about it. Okie dokie, bye. I have never been less reassured by anyone in my life. And the only thing that this made clear to me is that this guy is just not up to the challenge that has just been presented to him. Not if he cares about the future of this country. You know, when I was younger, I liked to believe that only great men could become president. That having to be judged and voted on by all Americans would weed out the bad guys. But the administration of George W. Bush proved that to be wrong. The illegal war, the torture, the global spying network he set up, so many laws broken. No one paid. And then our savior, Barack Obama, became the drone bomber, killed Americans, no trials, just murdered them. No charges, no one paid. And then Trump assassinated Iranian officials, tried to overthrow Venezuela, and attempted a coup to keep himself president. And it looks like he's getting away with all of it too. Presidents have been operating as if lawless for a long time, for my entire lifetime and then some. But there is a difference between law not being enforced and the law no longer applying. Because even during those lawless administrations, they still twisted themselves in knots trying to legally justify their actions so as to not end up in a cage for the rest of their lives. I remember the names of the George W. Bush lawyers, John Yoo, David Addington. They were important characters in those horrible years. Torture, murder, mass spying, coup attempts, both foreign and domestic, that all happened when presidents thought they could be prosecuted for crimes committed on the job. And now whatever deterrence for presidents existed during our past is gone. That's how they behaved when there was deterrence. And yes, I know crime is still crime and they're not allowed to commit them. But if there is no possible punishment, what's to stop them? What are they as individual humans to be afraid of? I want my president to be fearful of the consequences of breaking the law, just like the rest of us. I want my president to exercise caution on the job, because a lack of caution by the commander-in-chief can lead to a lot of dead people. Honestly, the people I fear for the most are those living in other countries, because our country has already been bombing others with impunity for over two decades. So what happens now that the legal restraints no longer matter? You know, for example, what happens when a president gets a call from another president or prime minister, say, hypothetically, one in the middle of committing a genocide, who is afraid of being prosecuted in his own country if he drops, say, a nuclear bomb on a caged population? Will our president, who now faces no such domestic legal consequences, be willing to do the dirty work for him? It's national security, after all, to arm and assist our allies. You know, what new level of lawlessness has the Supreme Court just unleashed? If the Supreme Court is worried about the extreme cautiousness of our former torturers and murderers in chief, what are future presidents going to do now that they are legally freed from all threats of accountability? How does it get worse than torture programs and murders and nuclear bombs? I fear it's just a matter of time before we're going to find out. And I don't say this to scare you. I don't want to scare you. And I'm sorry if I am. But I'm scared. I don't trust anyone with this power. I don't trust Donald Trump, and I don't trust Joe Biden. I don't trust any human being ever with that kind of power. But I don't trust Donald Trump or Joe Biden. They're both arrogant and violent men. I'm scared. I'm scared for the world. And unlike the other Supreme Court rulings, I don't see any path out of this one. Because the ruling says, quote, when the president exercises such authority, he may act even when the measures he takes are incompatible with the expressed or implied will of Congress, unquote. And it says, quote, an act of Congress, either a specific one targeted at the president or a generally applicable one, may not criminalize the president's actions within his exclusive constitutional power, unquote. And so it seems like Congress can't do anything about it. And President Biden isn't even pretending to try. And the American people? We're not in the streets. We're not organizing. This just seems like another event in a long stream of events that we are going to watch pass us by on this train to whatever form of government we're headed to. I don't know what that is, but I know it's the opposite direction of democracy. This feeling I have right now, I don't know how to describe it. All I know is how to compare it, because I've felt it before. 23 years ago, in the days after the 9/11 attacks, Representative Barbara Lee of Oakland, California, was the only person in Congress to vote against the authorization for the use of military force, warning that that one paragraph was a recipe for endless global war. In those scary days, as that paragraph was being signed into law and our troops were gearing up for a bloody future unknown, we knew something was changing. We knew that those words would have consequences, but we didn't know exactly what it would look like. But I just felt like something big was happening and that it wasn't going to be short term. And since then, Afghanistan, Iraq, Syria, Libya, Yemen, Somalia, Pakistan, Ukraine, Gaza, wars, endless and everywhere. And even when we're not involved, somehow we're always involved. 23 years ago, we couldn't see this future, but we felt it, and I have that same feeling now. And Justice Sotomayor kind of captured the vibe. She said, quote, when he uses his official powers in any way, under the majority's reasoning, he will now be insulated from criminal prosecution. Orders the Navy SEAL Team 6 to assassinate a political rival, immune. Organizes a military coup to hold on to power, immune. Takes a bribe in exchange for a pardon, immune. Immune. Immune, immune, unquote. She's picturing future scenarios, and I'm feeling that future too. Just like in those days after the disaster of 9/11, the pictures in the crystal ball are fuzzy. We don't know exactly what the future holds, but it feels like something big is happening, and it isn't going to be short term. So the minute that the immunity ruling came out, the way this went down is I saw it on Twitter on my phone. I opened the Supreme Court ruling, started reading it, and went, holy shit, this is happening. Went to my computer, started working this episode, and have not stopped for the last 2 days. And so because I turned this around so quickly, my sister had no time to get our executive producers together. So we may have some to announce. Thank you to everyone who is an executive producer and a producer at any level. I would not be able to do this podcast and have the team around me that allows me to turn this around so quickly. So thank you to Mike and Claire, who are helping me get this out to you on this 4th of July week. There's a very good possibility that you will be listening to this on the day that we celebrate the fact that we got our independence from a king, and yet the Supreme Court brought kings back, apparently. So I know on this 4th of July, this isn't going to be a celebratory kind of mood for me. This one's going to hit different. But you are the reason I'm able to turn this around as quickly as I am, because I'm able to have help. And so thank you to all producers. Please support the show. But what I'm going to ask of you today, I've already asked it twice, but I'm going to ask it a third time. Please share episode 266, Contriving January 6th, because at least if people are going to vote for Trump, they should at least know what he did. And that is the way that we can share it. I listened to the episode again while I was driving the other day, and it's a great episode. I have to pat myself on the back. It just explains what happened so well, and it's no explanation needed. The testimony does all the work. So please share that as widely as you can. And we'll just see what happens from here. Yeah, like I said, I don't know what the hell to do about any of this. So I'm going to just keep doing Congressional Dish with your help. So yeah, support the show on the Support the Show page on congressionaldish.com, and you can find the link to Contriving January 6th in this episode show notes. But thank you for listening. Thank you for supporting. And I will talk to you very soon. We're damn near done with the Boeing episode. So yeah, I'll have that out to you as soon as I can. Thanks. Talk to you soon.
We don't have a domestic spying program.
They're content to fight in black and white despite the many in-betweens. We got a president who plays with the facts.
With the facts.
And then he waves a flag to cover his tracks. As if a lie is all right, if the end will justify the means. Now we are so damn tired of being.
The polar ice caps aren't going away.
We don't think we can deny it anymore. You can stick to your story if you think it lies. But we're not keeping quiet anymore. We are so damn tired of being lied.
Government jobs consume the profits of the private sector.
We don't think we can deny it anymore. You can stick to your story if you think it flies. But we're not keeping quiet anymore.
These bills represent common sense, bipartisan solutions that actually solve problems.